Right, so I want to tell you about this idea that I think may hold a key to understanding quantum gravity, and it is called the holographic principle. It's a statement about how many degrees of freedom there are in nature at a fundamental level. And, well, if I give you a region of space, and I ask you how many degrees of freedom are there in this region, and coming from field theory intuition, you will probably say infinitely many, because there's basically degree of freedom at every point in space. Then you might think again and remember that there's really a smallest length scale, thanks to gravity, called the Planck length, about 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. And we can't resolve anything smaller than that. So that might prompt you to divide this region up into little Planck cubes and say maybe there's roughly 1 degree of freedom per Planck cube. But then you would get an answer that would still tell you that the number of degrees of freedom grows like the volume of the region that you're looking at, and is roughly given by the volume in Planck units. I'm going to be using Planck units throughout this talk. Now what the holographic principle tells you is that this intuition is wrong, and that in fact nature is far less complicated at a fundamental level than you would have naively expected, that in fact the number of degrees of freedom is no larger than the surface area that is bounding the region under consideration in Planck units and divided by 4. So I should really put the Planck length squared down here, but I'm going to forget about that most of the time. Now, given that this is a very small length and that nothing can be smaller than this, it's clear that the holographic principle tells you that the number of degrees of freedom is, for a typical macroscopic system, dozens of orders of magnitude smaller than you would have naively expected. Yes?
This is supposed to be at all energies or just at some low energy sector?
Let me postpone that until I actually explain to you where this comes from, and then either it'll be clear or you should ask the question again. So this is just a sort of setup, and now I want to tell you that my talk will have 2 parts. The first part will be to review historically where this idea came from, which basically means reviewing a couple of classical and semi-classical features of black hole physics, and combining them with the unitarity of quantum mechanics that basically allowed Etouff to come up with this idea. But I will also stress that this was true only for a limited class of systems. You couldn't infer more than that from the arguments that he used, which were essentially black holes plus quantum mechanics gives you the holographic principle. In the second part of the talk, after an interlude where I will basically talk about how recently in string theory this idea has been confirmed in a very dramatic way, in the second part I want to discuss how the holographic principle has recently sort of taken on a life of its own. It can be formulated in a way that is far more general than what you would have expected from the way in which it was originally derived, and that actually makes a statement about areas in arbitrary space-times, arbitrary areas, and links them to entropy in certain regions. So that's holographic principle in general space-times. And at the end of the day, I think today's point of view is rather that the features of black hole physics and quantum mechanics that allowed you to derive this should rather be viewed as a consequence of this formulation, which seems to be more general and perhaps more fundamental. And I will also hopefully have time to make some remarks about what you can learn from this principle about quantum gravity, and you know, whether you can infer certain features that you should be looking for in a general quantum theory of gravity. Good. So from now on, you should start asking questions whenever you don't understand something, because it's supposed to be comprehensible now. So around 1970, there were two facts about black hole physics, classical black hole physics, that were known at the time, both of which were quite interesting but apparently unrelated. The first was the black hole no-hair theorem, which was proven by Werner Israel and a bunch of other people, which essentially states that a black hole is characterized by only three numbers: its mass, its charge, and its angular momentum. Okay. That means you can't store, classically, you cannot really store any information in a black hole. Its entropy is essentially zero. This is classically. Another fact that was known, fact number two about black holes, was the area theorem, which was proven by Hawking, and which tells you that classically the area of event horizons can only ever increase or stay constant. And the kind of processes you might have in mind is where you throw an ordinary matter system into a black hole, you find that the area of its horizon, the outermost surface from which light cannot escape, grows in this process. But more interestingly, perhaps, if you take two black holes and throw them together, they form one bigger black hole, and the area theorem tells you that the area of the new black hole is larger than the sum of the areas that you started with. Okay. So let's write that as dA greater than or equal to zero. Okay. Now, Jacob Bekenstein looked at the left-hand side here and noticed that it allows for a violation of the second law of thermodynamics. How does it do that? Well, suppose you have, you're an observer and you have a thermodynamic system that consists of two parts. One is a black hole, and one is a matter system with entropy Sm. Okay. And now you have a thermodynamic process in which you throw the matter system into the black hole to make the black hole larger. Okay. Then you get a new black hole and no more matter system. That means you started with a total entropy of Sm and ended up with entropy zero. So you violated the second law of thermodynamics. Yes?
In what sense can you consider this to be an equilibrium process? Mm-hmm. You know, how does equilibrium apply here?
Mm-hmm. Well, you can take a limit where you have the black hole and the matter system very far separated. So, say the observer and his friend sit at infinity in Minkowski space, and the black hole, or in the Schwarzschild space-time, and the black hole sits in the center. So in the limit where you take the separation to be very large, the acceleration that you need goes to zero to, you know, keep these things separated. So you can get arbitrarily close to equilibrium.
Even if it's not equilibrium, it goes in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, it definitely wants to complete this process. But I guess you could ask whether you could consider the initial state an equilibrium state.
Oh, the initial, yes.
But you can formulate the entropy even for non-equilibrium
right.
states. Right.
Right. But, mechanics. I mean, I think I can answer this question without even any recourse to that. good. So you have this apparent violation of the second law of thermodynamics. That was recognized. And Bekenstein then looked at the right-hand side of what I've written here and noticed that there's a, well, this was actually noticed before, but not taken seriously. And obviously, this is a very suggestive formula. There's, what other thing in nature do you know that can only ever increase? Thermodynamic entropy. What was that, Joe? Joe knows another thing.
My weight.
So apart from Joe's weight and thermodynamic entropy, this is yeah. I hope there's a bound on that too. all right. good. So Bekenstein took this analogy very seriously and said, we should literally assign an entropy to black holes. They have an entropy, namely, equal to their surface area, divided by some number of order 1, which was later fixed to be 4. Okay. So he said the second law is out the window, but it's just transcended and should be replaced by a generalized second law in which you consider to be the entropy always the sum of ordinary matter entropy plus a quarter of all the horizon areas that are present. Okay? And with that definition, it turns out that the generalized second law is upheld.
Is there actually a physical argument why A should correspond to some sort of generalized entropy, or just purely on the basis that it has to always increase?
Initially, it was purely on the basis that this always increases, and it caused several people to shake their heads. First of all, it wasn't clear at all what the microscopic states are that are supposed to be underlying this entropy, given that the no-hair theorem seemed to tell you that there weren't any. There was also another problem, which was that if a black hole has entropy, and it clearly has also energy, therefore it must have a temperature, and it must radiate, and that seemed totally absurd at the time. So Stephen Hawking was shaking his head going, this is stupid. And then he was thinking again, and he realized, wait a minute, actually they do radiate. And I think that was really what established black hole entropy in the community as an accepted concept. When Hawking found that black holes actually do have a temperature that fits thermodynamically exactly with what you would have expected from this assignment of entropy. And also, it was Hawking's calculation that fixed this factor of a quarter here. It was really as a consequence of that this idea of black hole entropy became so widely accepted, and that people then went ahead and said, okay, we have to find what these microstates are. They must be a quantum effect that we do not see in a classical description. Mm-hmm. And still today, that is a somewhat puzzling question, although certainly in the last 5 years or so, string theory has made a huge amount of progress in identifying microstates for certain classes of black holes.
Socrates thought experiment told you there should be some relation like this, but doesn't fix the coefficient.
Yeah, he did not know what the coefficient is.
Hawking
fixed the coefficient.
He had some kind of bound on it from the thought experiments, but you really can't pin it down.
No. Yeah, you can't pin it down. In fact, and I'm going to come to this is basically my next step, just by saying, okay, the area always increases. That doesn't guarantee that the generalized second law is going to be valid. The question is whether it increases enough to make up for the lost matter entropy. Okay. And unless you have some other way of figuring out how much is, the maximum entropy of a matter system, you can't fix the coefficient by this argument. But what I'm going to do now is get to the stage where people accepted black hole entropy as a fact and turned the logic around and said, I can derive a bound on the entropy of matter systems by turning them into black holes or throwing them into black holes, checking how much does the area increase, and then the entropy definitely had to be less than that. And I'll go through this right now, so in case you're confused. Let me just erase all of this.
I know those microstates were originally described in terms of string theory. Has anybody tried to describe those microstates without string theory? Or it has to be string theory absolutely essential? Did that tell us something about string theory? No?
Well, the subject of how people started discovering these microstates, which was basically a consequence of an idea that Joe had, an idea of deep brains,
right.
is such a fascinating and vast subject, and there are so many people who know more about it than I do, that it deserves more than just a passing comment in my talk. But the basic idea is that you can relate certain black holes, unfortunately not all of them, and particularly not the chargeless ones are very hard to understand this way. To systems of stacks of these deep brains, and you can understand the degrees of freedom of these black holes as the strings that are connecting between these deep brains. Deep brains are brains on which strings end. I don't have time if I want to get through.
No, my question is actually kind of the converse. Whether non-stringy quantum gravity people have tried to.
No, the answer to your question is yes. They have tried. So-called quantum theory of geometry, mm-hmm. people in Ashtekar and company, also has a limitation.
Right.
We started to talk
by Steve Carlin on
Thursday.
So he was describing some idea that any real theory of quantum gravity is either black holes,
right,
there would be a symmetry and a solution in this world.
Well, that seemed to me a very interesting issue because it tells us whether string theory is.
I couldn't remember. Sorry, last.
I think there was also a problem that people weren't able to fix the coefficient. In,
yeah, very plastic.
They cannot fix the coefficient.
Yeah. In string theory, they can.
Right.
But I think, yeah, good. Let's.
His question was, is anybody working
Right. Now, before I continue with this entropy bound argument, I want to make clear some questions of language. By the number of degrees of freedom, which is something that I keep talking about a lot, I really mean the logarithm of the dimension of the Hilbert space of a quantum system. Yeah. So, in other words, the holographic principle could be rephrased as saying that the dimension of the Hilbert space describing the system completely is less than or equal to e to the area over 4, where area is the where this is the area bounding the system. Okay. Note that this means that a harmonic oscillator has an infinite number of degrees of freedom. So if you want to keep, and I find this useful to keep some sort of example system in the back of my head when I'm talking about this, a good system to have in your mind is one in which you basically have a set of spins, which can point up and down. So then your Hilbert space has dimension 2 to the n. And in that case, the number of degrees of freedom up to a factor of ln2 is basically the number of spins that you have around. So that's just a useful thing to think of when talking about these things.
So is this the point you should answer Kivelson's question?
Sorry?
Kivelson asked some question about energy.
Not quite yet.
Not quite yet.
Okay. yeah, I'll get there. The other trivial fact that I nevertheless want to emphasize is that with this definition of the number of degrees of freedom, the thermodynamic entropy of the system can be as large as n, but no larger than that. It can also be smaller. Okay. And since the holographic principle suggests in many ways that we don't really understand what the degrees of freedom are, the way to test it is usually to look at the entropy of a configuration. Certainly, if that exceeded the area, then you could be sure that the holographic principle was violated. And that's why I will be talking about entropy a lot in this talk. So, take a matter system, and let's make it spherical for simplicity. I will later in the talk tell you what to do when your surfaces are not spheres. So take a matter system bounded by some sphere, and let that matter system be a stable thing, and gravity be weak, it's not already collapsing into a black hole. And what you can do with this is take a huge shell of matter which has a mass just large enough to turn this into a black hole of the same area. So you collapse the shell around it and add as much mass as you need so that the mass is now equal to the radius, essentially, or radius over 2. Okay. Then it's a black hole. Yes?
That's something I presume we should know, that the mass of the black hole is proportional to its radius.
Yes.
It's not obvious.
That follows from the solution that described black holes, which is the Schwarzschild solution. And they tell you that the singularity is at a zero of this function. Sorry, not a singularity, that the horizon of the black hole is a zero of this function.
Yeah.
Okay. So for a black hole, R is equal to 2m in those one dimensions. So now I've told you again about a thermodynamic process in which you started with matter entropy Sm. You ended up with an entropy equal to A over 4 because you ended up with a black hole. Well, then by the generalized second law of thermodynamics, the matter entropy you started with had to be less than A over 4. And this is not exactly what Bekenstein derived, but I'll call it the Bekenstein bound. This was derived in 1981. It follows from what he derived immediately. And it's more useful in this form to what I'm going to say. It's interesting that it took Bekenstein from 1972, when he did his work on black hole entropy, to 1981 to come up with the statement of a universal entropy bound on matter systems given by the area.
Might be useful to remark that he did it here.
Is that right? Was he distracted?
And I have the references of these papers for people who are interested. I can write them down, or you can come and ask me later on. Good. So this statement that the entropy of a system is less than the surface area in Planck units, completely in general and independently of what kind of matter you've got here, is quite interesting, but it is not in itself perhaps a revolution. You can understand that statement without looking at any dramatic changes of your picture of the world. The point is simply that think of a cube, whatever, for simplicity, 10 Planck lengths on the edge. Field theory with a Planck cutoff might tell you that you have 1,000 spins like that distributed in this cube, so n will be 1,000. The entropy, according to Bekenstein's bound, will be no more than 100. That's not, first of all, that's not a contradiction with the statement that the entropy is always less than n. That's perfectly fine. The only thing you might wonder about is why you can't get larger entropy. And you can understand that perfectly straightforwardly by noticing that entropy doesn't come for free. In order to introduce entropy, to actually store information in your spin system, your spins can't all be pointing in the same direction. That means every time you turn one of them around, you introduce energy. You make this thing heavier. Okay? And recall that the scales we're talking about here are quite extreme. They're at the Planck length. So it's not unreasonable to say that when I try to create too much chaos, when I try to store too much information in here, the thing gets so heavy that it will collapse under its own weight. So once I include gravity in the equation, I have to keep in mind that for this to be stable, the radius has to still be larger than the mass. When I turn on, in some sense, more than 100 of these 1,000 degrees of freedom, what's happening is that the system just gets too heavy, and it's no longer stable, violating the original assumption I made in the beginning.
Can I imagine a spin-spin coupling where zero is some power of 1 over n?
Not according to Bekenstein's bound.
I see. So people are trying to...
So you can view this as a statement about what is physically reasonable.
Now, in the usual formulation of field theory, you're using the spin language, as you said. That's what you prefer. But in the usual formulation, you would have harmonic oscillators, right?
Yeah.
You have an infinite number of them.
Right. It would again tell you that you cannot use them.
Right.
It's the same argument. It's just that the discrepancy between N and S would be even larger.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
It even makes that argument stronger.
Well, following Tony's argument, there's still some quantum in here. So the spin is h bar, and the magnetic moment is inversely proportional to the mass of the particle. Mm-hmm. The spin-spin coupling could be the ordinary spin-spin coupling, and then you would possibly find some interesting result on the maximum mass of an elementary spin-n particle.
That sounds interesting. I'm not sure I followed it all the way, but it seems like something that I'd like to talk to you about.
Do you think the bound exists even if you turn gravity off? There's no gravitational field, you just take a statistical mechanical system and calculate it.
Well, Bekenstein would argue... Right. The units are such that if you take h bar to zero, there's really a g and an h bar here at the denominator. So if you take h bar to zero, the bound becomes trivial.
But the actual bound the Bekenstein holds wasn't this.
Yeah, that's I said
over
that. Yeah.
Smaller than r,
yeah.
And there's no h bar and no.
Right, and in the case of the, and that's why Bekenstein, in fact, in his paper where he introduced this bound, in the form in which he wrote it, did not contain G. Actually argued for it independently of gravitational physics, and he wrote many papers in which he examined systems in which gravity was negligible, and where you could nevertheless nearly saturate this bound but not exceed it.
So what's the bottom line on that?
Nobody's ever found one, as far as I can tell. There is One way in which you can violate these bounds apparently quite easily, which is by proliferating the number of massless non-interacting species in nature. So in that case, you would have to say that you view this bound as a prediction that that is not an exponentially large number. It does seem to agree with what we know. Okay, so I've basically given you one way of interpreting this result, which is a sort of traditional, conventional way. You can still think of all of these degrees of freedom as really being there. It's just that you can't use too many of them at the same time to store information or to generate entropy. And it took another 12 years. This is a subject with a lot of time gaps.
What is the fundamental definition of entropy that's being used here? Is it trace rho log rho or rho density matrix?
So, well, I would use the definition that keeping the boundary conditions, which in this case are geometric conditions, just the size of the surface in which this system is supposed to fit, keeping those fixed, how many states are accessible to the system?
What is the definition of accessible?
So, for example, at any energy that will not produce a black hole larger than the boundary area. So I'm not just I'm not in fact fixing the energy in this picture. I'm putting in an upper limit on the energy because if it's larger than a certain value, then you will get a black hole that doesn't fit into the surface that you've specified anymore. So, you know, you give me a Hilbert space and you calculate how many states are compatible with those boundary conditions, take the log, and that's the entropy. So that's the conventional way. And then in 1993, Atuf came up with a much more radical interpretation of why this bound holds. Namely, he said basically that this bound is just a trivial consequence of the stronger and perhaps crazier statement that the number of degrees of freedom that underlie any entropy, the number of degrees of freedom in this system is already bounded by the area over 4. Then the entropy bound just follows from what I said in the beginning, that the entropy is always less than the number of degrees of freedom. But this is, of course, a statement that seems to be in blatant contradiction with what we know about field theory, in fact, what we know about locality in physics. So I should give the, since this is on the web, it's a nice paper to look at. And a year later, Susskind wrote also a paper on this idea of the holographic principle, in which he discussed this more. So why would it have come up with this idea? Why such a radical statement when there was an easy explanation? Yes?
So I guess I don't see why this is quite that much more radical than the original statement. I mean, it seems a little bit semantical, right? You just define death as
an espousum-variant example doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Right, it tells you that, you know, beforehand, you could say quantum field theory is a wonderful description of nature. It is, you know, it's conceptually correct. It gives me the right number of degrees of freedom. If I turn on too many of them, I pay the price of gravitational collapse, but they're still all there. Okay. Atuf is saying something different, saying that quantum field theory might be a good approximation, but it's conceptually wrong. It has all these degrees of freedom in it that must be somehow gauge degrees of freedom or that, you know, that don't really exist physically. So why would he come up with that? Well, one argument which I still find is the most compelling, actually, is an argument of economy, basically Occam's razor. If I can't use more than 100, then I shouldn't carry all this load around with me.
Okay. Well.
That's, as far as I can tell, the argument that he used in his paper. So I'm going to blame it on Atuf.
I think I should be a second Nobel Prize.
But I can give you a slightly better argument, I think, than that, which is you want things to be consistent with unitarity, with the laws of quantum mechanics. Okay. Now, at least for black holes, because the entropy is A over 4 and you have no other information about these systems, maybe you will buy the statement that the number of degrees of freedom of a black hole are also equal to A over 4. Now, once you accept that, you're going to have to buy this. And that's because unitarity requires it. I can go back to my experiment where I collapse a shell around a system. Suppose this system, this ordinary matter system, had numbers of degrees of freedom going like the volume. Okay. Now I have a scattering experiment in which a shell comes in, turns it into a black hole with n equals a. So suddenly my Hilbert space has shrunk dramatically. I cannot have unitarity in this process unless the number of degrees of freedom was a, well, or to start with. Okay. So that, I think, is really the deeper reason why you want to make a statement like this. If you want to have any hope of reconciling, you know, the principles of gravity and those of quantum mechanics, then something like that better be true. Good. But
the argument in the original position is obvious.
Sorry?
Why A overpowers the number of degrees of freedom as opposed to the number of degrees of freedom that are assessed by the
system? Yeah, I know. This is not a logic. This
the one derivation yeah. where it's divided, why it doesn't appear like it has other degrees of freedom.
You mean the. Yeah. 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 No, I have to agree with that. I don't think there is a really strict way of deriving this statement from black hole physics. And I'm not too bothered by that.
It's not even strict, but I don't see any argument.
Well, yeah, I think it depends what you call an argument. I mean, I think the argument of economy or an argument where you say black hole has these numbers, degrees of freedom.
But
is a reasonable
case,
argument.
Based on one case where you actually calculate that, right?
Uh-huh.
It doesn't really satisfy. N is not equal to AR4.
What's A in the calculation?
Sorry?
What's A in the beginning of the calculation? What you're
referring to? Well, A is the area of the black hole that you get, and then set a limit which you don't. Which in going to that limit, the number of degrees of freedom of black holes, the not that entropy is involved.
In what sense are there more degrees of freedom? So what would happen if you turn them on? What would they describe?
Then you do get
about the number of degrees of freedom.
That's not the number of states that exist in the whole dimension of the outer space.
Not if you put the bound in the energy.
That's the
usual
argument, right?
Yeah, so you're saying that really the situation isn't any different from... It would still be consistent with this idea.
Yeah.
Okay. Can I postpone this discussion? The reason why, okay, I think I'll grant you that the example of deep brains is a good example to show that the argument about saying that a black hole really has n equals a over 4 may or may not be sound. That depends on how literally you take the deep brain description to be a black hole. But I'm not too bothered about a derivation of this bound simply because I know for sure that I cannot derive it from known physical principles in the generality in which it is now formulated and in which I believe it is actually true anyway. So all I can do is try to give you a sort of, you know, didactic idea of why you might come up with something like this. When I write down the covariant form of the energy bound, there is, I think, a much better argument for why that should not be taken just as an energy bound, as an entropy bound, excuse me. But, you know, why that simply makes no sense unless you interpret it to be a bound on the number of degrees of freedom. And let me come to that and 20 minutes when I talk about that. Yes?
So I'm surprised you haven't mentioned another compelling argument for this, which is that if you don't assume these kinds of bounds, you get into a paradox, a black hole information paradox.
Well, isn't that the same thing as unitarity?
Well, okay. Certainly there are other ideas for how you could resolve that where you have unitarity obey, for example, the notion of remnant. You get into trouble with that as well.
Yes, but I still, what would an argument be that uses the black hole information paradox that is different from what I said about unitarity?
Well, okay, you might imagine that the black hole has more microstates than that.
Okay.
And that you do have unitary processes taking place, and that somehow when a black hole evaporates, it leaves something behind. And so you still have...
Well, why couldn't the information that is stored in these more than A microstates also come out in the Hawking radiation?
Well, it could, or it may or may not.
Right. I mean, because we, from Hawking's calculation, we don't see how the information comes out anyway, so it's hard to say that it should be only A and not B. Yes?
Just trying to make sure I'm understanding the distinction here. So if I use your spin-in analogy, where I put a spin on every site,
yes,
then certainly I could get to a high temperature state with a volume of entropy.
Yes.
Okay, in your statement, that would be corresponding to a number of degrees of freedom that field theory would say is fine. I mean, forget about energy.
You have to keep in mind that you can't get the temperature higher than the Planck temperature.
No, I'm not. I'm putting one spin on every site.
Okay.
I'm getting the temperature higher than the mass
what
that
the word
would make it collapse.
Mean? Site,
yeah. Okay, you want to make it collapse. So you,
no,
you,
no, I'm not going to make it collapse. I'm going to do it very fast so it doesn't have time to collapse. I'm just going to heat up the spins so they're completely random. Okay, so my temperature, I don't know, is now huge. The energy is huge. But I certainly have enough degrees of freedom there.
Mm-hmm. I'm confused. What is the statement?
I'm trying to understand your difference between
you can't do that.
Yeah, that's what that's what the difference is between counting entropy and counting degrees of freedom. You're saying that somehow, no matter how much I heated it up, I would never get that many states.
I think he's saying even the moderate interpretation can do it.
Yeah, absolutely. But basically exactly. Mm-hmm. And it's hard but possible to actually check examples for this. Now you calculate the mass and you check, you know, how heavy something, how much
entropy
you can generate. I mean, it's not the temperature that is critical here, but the energy.
Well, right.
Yeah, so then in a system where they are, you could not make the temperature larger than the radius of the system. Okay. Good. So another way of stating the holographic principle, as which also was first introduced by Etoff, is to say the world is a bit like a hologram. You can describe the physics in a region of space completely by data stored on the boundary at 1 bit per Planck area. Okay. Now, I think the reason why this is such an interesting statement is that it's in apparent conflict with local physics, with local field theories. And by the way, that makes string theory look pretty good, because it's not a local field theory. But what, you know, what when you have a statement that seems to be very general and simple like this, and it's in conflict with your usual description of physics, then you might hope that there exists a different, perhaps more fundamental description in which this principle is manifest, in which you're no longer terribly surprised by it, in which it's sort of built in. And I think from the history of what sort of arguments this has come from, it's not unreasonable to expect that if you find such a description, you've gone a long way to understanding quantum gravity. And as far as I can tell, there are two ways in which you might try to resolve this contradiction between the holographic principle and locality. And which one of them you prefer basically depends on which of the prices that you pay you consider more horrible. So, I think they both have huge problems. I mean, one possibility is that you look for a description in which you only have the physical degrees of freedom present. In that case, how do you reconstruct locality? Another possibility is that you look for a description in which you have physical degrees of freedom and a number of explicitly identified gauge degrees of freedom, or lack of a better word, I call them gauge degrees of freedom. Degrees of freedom that you can somehow identify straightforwardly as not containing physical information, but which make sure that the total number of degrees of freedom goes like the volume and you still have a local theory. In that case, the problem is trying to figure out why on earth you have a number of gauge degree of freedom that goes like volume minus area. I don't think any of these problems is satisfactorily understood.
You use the phrase degrees of freedom a lot.
Yeah.
And now, if I remember the elementary courses I took way back, that requires some dynamical theory to say what the degrees of freedom are. So you are actually defining by the quantum in the upper left corner of the line.
Yeah.
That's the definition of the
That's
phrase,
my
degrees
yeah.
of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
So the term degrees of freedom can only be defined then in quantum mechanics.
Only in quantum mechanics.
Only in quantum mechanics.
So we get into even more trouble if we worry about the fact that quantum mechanics might not actually make sense.
Right.
But I'm hoping that if it doesn't, the concept of degrees of freedom will admit some kind of generalization that still doesn't make sense.
Right.
But you know, in view of what we have, that's the only definition I can give you.
Okay.
Yes.
If you took your spin system.
Yes.
And you fix the temperature, then you would have apparently large n equals 1,000 degrees of freedom, but the entropy would clearly be on the order of some smaller number. That doesn't seem to fit into either one of these two paradigms you just described, and yet it still has.
No, I think it does. It does fit into either, really, because what this principle implies is that there are some subtle non-local correlations between the things that we think are degrees of freedom. And those correlations must come in either in how we identify the gauge degrees of freedom or in the reconstruction of the local description from a theory which must be somehow pre-geometric in which you only have the degrees of freedom that are physical. But that is the big problem, so I don't know how exactly these correlations are encoded. I'm in trouble, actually. So let's see. Let me just say a few words about the work of Juan Maldacena in 1997, which really propelled the holographic principle, I think, into the into a bit more limelight than it had before. What Maldacena was able to do was, building on the developments in connection with D-brains, the second superstring revolution, he was able to actually give an explicit non-perturbative definition of quantum gravity in, unfortunately, a very limited class of spacetimes, certain spacetimes that are asymptotically anti-de Sitter, and I won't tell you very much about what that means. His example was a space time that was ADS 5 cross S 5, but just think of anti-de Sitter now. Let me try to summarize this very quickly. Anti-de Sitter space can be visualized as the interior of a cylinder. Okay, I'm always going to draw time going up. Okay, so this is just a trivial time direction. The space-like slices are all the same, and constant time hypersurface here is basically a disk of whatever number of dimensions you want to think, maybe three. And it has a boundary at the infinity of space-time, which is, if you think of this being three-dimensional, which would be a two-sphere. Okay. And what Mavacina was able to do, and let me also give you that reference. Okay. Was to show that quantum gravity, or more precisely type 2B string theory, in the bulk of this space-time is equivalent, can be mapped in a one-to-one way, to a conformal field theory that can be thought of as being defined on that boundary. And the mapping is very complicated, and you know, people have been working for 3 years on understanding it. But it is widely believed that this correspondence is correct, and that you can describe all of what's going on in here, including gravitational effects, by a theory that doesn't even contain gravity and that lives in one less dimension. All right. Now that's not the same thing as, that's not enough to establish that the holographic principle is manifest here. We also have to establish that this theory has no more than 1 degree of freedom per Planck area. And that was checked by Susskind and Witten in this paper. Okay. Now what made this result so dramatic from the point of view of those of us who are interested in the holographic principle was that it provided an explicit manifestation of the holographic principle. You actually could write down a theory that would only have the physical degrees of freedom in it and find a dictionary between that theory and gravitational physics in the bulk. And as you might have expected from all the things that led up to the holographic principle, that theory is a quantum theory of gravity. Okay. So this was a huge success. Yes?
To be precise, what they...
which I'm far from being.
More of the holographic representation here as opposed to the finite number. I mean, they don't, in matching the entropy,
they put it in the UV cutoff and show things match.
Right.
But they never showed how the H theory really has a UV cutoff inherently built in. So, strictly speaking,
but it's non-trivial that there is a matching between the infrared cutoff and the UV cutoff.
In no sense is the number of degrees of freedom finite.
It is. Once you have a cutoff, the number of degrees of freedom is finite.
If within a given spatial volume, the number is finite because the spatial cutoff in the bulk is the energy cutoff in the gauge.
That's all you really need here. I think. Yeah. So anyway, people are very excited about this. And you would think now that we have an example for these weird spacetimes which are anti-de Sitter at infinity. I should say that unfortunately these spacetimes have absolutely no similarity to any spacetime that we might possibly be interested in. Such as, for example, flat space, which we use in scattering experiments, or cosmological solutions with any similarity to the ones that we live in. And that's unfortunate, but...
Actually, that's an extreme statement. The large radius limit of this locally looks just like space.
And but how much of... apart from recent paper by Veronica, the amount of information that has been learned about flat space from the ADS CFT correspondence is very limited because it turned out that it's not at all trivial to simply take a limit of large curvature radius of this and try to extract flat space holography from it. I mean, that is an obvious strategy that you might want to follow, but I don't think it has delivered a lot. Anyway, let me not get hung up on that point. Because
in particular, the volume and the area are the same, which is one thing.
Which might explain why this was the first time where we discovered holography.
So it's not
Actually, it's not as trivial. I mean, if you read the Susskind and Witten paper, they point out that. Let me bug up in this. The main reason why I mentioned it is, first of all, that it historically attracted a lot of attention to the holographic principle, and secondly, that it established a kind of paradigm in which people started expecting that the holographic principle means that you have a theory living on the boundary of space-time. Okay. And that's a problem. It's not at all clear what you even mean by the boundary of space-time in, say, a closed universe, which doesn't have a boundary. Okay. But even in many other space-times, the structure of the boundary is so radically different from anti-de Sitter space that it's very hard to draw any analogies between the way in which holography manifests itself here and the way you might expect it to work in other space-times. So that's problem number one. This idea that, you know, every space-time has some kind of holographic screen, maybe a boundary of infinity, on which you can store all of these data, slice by slice, store all the bulk information on the boundary. It's not straightforward to see how that would generalize. And there was a second problem, which has nothing to do with AES CFT. And I'm basically trying to set up two problems so then it would be more impressive to see that they can be solved. The second problem goes back to the arguments that I used to establish the holographic principle in the first place. It all hinged on this experiment where you turn the system into a black hole. And it turns out that there were assumptions involved here. Now, the system had to be weakly gravitating. It had to be not already inside a black hole, for example, and collapsing rapidly, in order for you to be able to do this process. And if you forget about these assumptions, then you can easily violate Bekenstein's bound, and therefore the holographic principle, for systems which are not weakly gravitating. And let me give you two examples for that. One would be a system like a star that is undergoing gravitational collapse. It's collapsing to a single point, to a singularity. Now, the entropy cannot decrease, but the surface area clearly is going down. So sooner or later, as you approach this point, you will have an entropy greater than the area of this, the surface area of the star. That's in violation of the holographic principle. Another example, and that was actually one that was highlighted by Fischler and Susskind in a paper that addressed this problem, and which I should also mention.
Isn't that by definition, by your previous definition, just the area where you have actually become a black hole?
Well, it's absolutely correct that this means that the star is already a black hole and there's a black hole horizon around it. But that doesn't mean that you can't have a guy sitting here who's observing the star who's also in the black hole.
Oh, okay.
Right? I mean, physics should be independent of, you know, whether you have some guy sitting in infinity. For that guy, it's okay. It's just a black hole. Everything's fine. But, you know, you can also say, okay, here's someone who's looking at the star from, you know, close by. And this guy will see, perhaps, that there's a violation. Well, I'll get to this.
It doesn't fall in homogeneous.
Sir?
It doesn't fall in like sort of shrinking in one go.
Well,
I mean, you form a small black hole, it's rapidly grows. Things fall in faster at the center, right?
Well, it doesn't matter. I mean, as soon as this thing is slightly smaller than its horizon, than the black hole horizon associated with it, you can already have a violation of the bound. Whether that corresponds to any physical measurement is something that I would doubt very much, and that has to do with the resolution of this problem. But let me go ahead and give you another example of why.
Well, like if for this observer outside there, it isn't a black hole also, but just a smaller one.
What's that?
Never mind.
Well, let's not talk about what physical observations are, but let's talk just about the mathematical statement that the entropy in a spatial volume enclosed by an area is greater than that area. I think we all agree on that. In this counterexample, it's greater than the area. Okay. you can construct another counterexample, which is sort of the opposite. Instead of rapid contraction, you have rapid expansion. If you take a flat expanding universe, constant time hypersurfaces are just R3, flat space. The density of entropy is roughly constant. You have flat space. Now we can play a game where we just look at larger and larger spheres. The entropy within them grows like the volume because of this. But the area only grows like the area. It's ordinary flat space, so we know how things behave. So by just taking a large enough sphere, you can have, again, a violation of Bekenstein's bound. It turns out that this only happens if you take your sphere to be much larger than the Hubble horizon. But still, in principle, there's a problem. Now, I'm horribly out of time, so I won't actually have time to discuss in great detail how exactly this problem is resolved. But the basic strategy is to call for something that was always a principle that relativists like a lot. The idea that all physical laws should be formulated in a generally coordinate invariant way. So if you demand covariance, you notice immediately that the holographic principle was not originally formulated in a covariant way. If I say that, let me now start with the area. Okay, given an area, the old way of stating the principle was the entropy of the number of degrees of freedom in the spatial volume inside that area is less than A. There are two ambiguities in that statement. One is, what do you mean by inside? In a general spacetime, you could have space-like slices that are three spheres, and your surface could be a two-sphere on that three-sphere. Which side is inside? When this thing is wildly dynamical, it's even less obvious what you might want to choose. And the other ambiguity is that there's no such thing as the space-like volume, or the spatial volume inside A. In a space-time picture, there are many different spatial hypersurfaces that I can draw, depending on how I define my time coordinate, through A. Okay. So if I demand covariance, then the bound has to hold for all of them. And I already know that that's not true. And the only way out is, instead of formulating the bound on space-like regions inside, you look at null hypersurfaces. And those are surfaces which are generated by light rays through the two-dimensional surface that you started with. Keep in mind that this is always a two-dimensional surface at an instant of time. Okay? So you can, for example, imagine that the room here is spherical, and at an instant of time, the wall flashes up. There are little light bulbs everywhere, and they flash up simultaneously. And there are these light rays traveling towards the center, and they generate what's called a null hypersurface, a 2 plus 1 dimensional surface, which has two spatial directions and one light-like direction. Light, I always draw at 45 degrees, more or less. Okay. Now, it turns out that there are four of these things, and no more. Spatial hypersurfaces, there are infinitely many. You can just deform very easily. This is very strictly fixed. Once you take orthogonal light rays, well, they just go where they go, and they generate a surface. But you could have taken them to go towards the past instead of the future, or to flash up a little light bulb in the center of the room some time ago so that the light rays reach the wall simultaneously. That will generate another null hypersurface bounded by A. And then, of course, you could have light bulbs on the outside of the room that send light rays to the outside, past and future. They're just really continuations of these cones, but let's call them skirts. Okay, so there are precisely four. And with that restriction, it's now much easier to resolve the second ambiguity, the question of what you mean by the inside. Okay. If I give you a surface, and let's forget about time and think about Euclidean geometry for a minute, and I give you some rays through that surface. You don't have to know where infinity is to figure out where the inside is. You just follow the rays, you know, by trial and error to one side, a little step, and you check whether the area that's spanned by them has grown or shrunk compared to the one you started with. If it has shrunk, you've gone inside. If it's grown, you've gone outside. And you can do precisely that for these four possibilities. Let me draw the sphere just as a point, and the four possibilities are these four legs of the X. You just check, is the area growing or shrinking in that direction? The cross-section area spanned by the light rays that are moving in or out. Okay. If it is, then I call that an allowed direction, and the surface that it generates a light sheet. And if it's expanding, then I forget about this and say that the entropy on it has nothing to do with the area. But the statement of the generalized formulation is that the entropy on all light sheets is less than A over 4. You can see immediately that there will always be at least two of them. Because if the area is decreasing and increasing in that direction, it must be decreasing in the opposite one. So out of these four, there will always be at least two legs that correspond to light sheets, correspond to allowed directions. And the entropy passing through those is less than A over 4. Now, one important thing is that you can see fairly easily that you can reconstruct the old formulation from this. Namely, for weakly gravitating systems, you would expect that the inside is what you usually mean by the inside, and you can send a light to the future and past inside. So it's one of these wedges. And that also, the light will actually have a chance to traverse the room and get to the center. If it's not weakly gravitating, you might have a singularity here that cuts off the cone. You couldn't assume that. But with weak gravitation, you can. Then the covariant entropy bound, this thing here, tells you that the entropy passing through this cone is less than A over 4. But then by the second law, the entropy on any space-like slice through A also had to be less than A over 4. Because all of that entropy later has to go through the cone. So important test number one is that you recover the old formulation as a special case.
What do you mean that entropy passes through?
I mean that basically in the same way. In the old formulation, I could have said the entropy in the spatial volume bounded by A. Okay. I could have also said the entropy passing through the spatial hypersurface in the part of it that is interior to A. If I introduce a temporal sense as well. Passing means in a temporal sense. Okay. And in that same sense, I can think of that entropy as passing through this cone just as it passes through that spatial hypersurface. Mm-hmm. So there's really no significant difference in what we mean, apart from possibly a set of measure zero light rays that are precisely lying on the cone. Yes?
Rafael, I'm sitting here wondering if people that want to modify quantum mechanics or give up quantum mechanics and so on, do those people have anything useful to say, useful or sensible on this whole subject?
Can I defer that question to after my talk?
Okay.
Because it seems a little peripheral to what I'm just trying to get one or two more points across before David is going to throw me out. Good. Let me quickly run through an example that, please feel free to leave, I'm really sorry to be over time. That sort of illustrates the power of this formulation. Before I do that, I'm sorry. One thing you should know, I've written it down as an entropy bound. I haven't yet said anything about the number of degrees of freedom. Of course, I'm going to say that the same thing applies. But what I want to stress is, coming back to David's remarks earlier on, that with this formulation, it's much harder to avoid this step, to go to the stronger statement that it's a bound on the number of degrees of freedom. Why is that? Well, it's a formulation that is manifestly time reversal invariant. I haven't said anything about past or future. I've said there are four directions, some of which are past, some of which are future, and I've given you a local and covariant rule for picking out two allowed ones, which might be past, might be future. That depends on the actual geometry. But there's no reference to the time direction here. So how can this be
passing through?
Well, it doesn't matter whether it's passing through this way or that way. that doesn't matter. So you can completely time reverse and it will still be the same law. But it doesn't make sense, I think, to have a time reversible law about entropy unless the law of, from the start was actually referring to the degrees of freedom that underlie that entropy. Only then, I think, will I not be surprised to see that it's time reversible invariant. But that's perhaps the best I can do to answer your earlier question of why you might want to take that step. Once you have the covariant formulation, I think that step is fairly inevitable. Okay. A closed universe is a good example of illustrating why things no longer go wrong, because it was also a good example of illustrating why they do go wrong in the old formulation. Okay. I have a funny way of drawing three spheres. I draw them as a line. What this really means is that these two points are the north and south pole, and all the other points are really two spheres like that. Okay? And now a closed universe is one where you start with a big bang, your three spheres are expanding, and then they contract again in a big crunch. And a diagram that reflects the causal structure of this correctly looks like this. So this would be the largest three sphere at the turnaround time. These would be the smaller three spheres that approach the Big Bang, and the wiggly line down here is the Big Bang. And here they contract again. Okay? So let me erase all the three spheres. We've seen from what I told you before that a good way of classifying spherical surfaces under this bound is to draw little wedges that symbolize which of the four directions are the allowed ones. Okay? So every point in this diagram is a two-sphere, except for the ones on the north and south pole here. Okay. These will be very little two-spheres because they're sort of near the pole. This will be an equator. Okay. Now, it's not too hard to guess that the two-spheres near the pole will have allowed directions towards the pole. Right. You send your light rays that way. That way the cross-sectional area gets smaller. Similarly, on the other pole, it doesn't matter whether you send them to the past or to the future, as long as you send them to the pole. But near the Big Bang, a two-sphere right here is in a region where space is expanding extremely rapidly. It's basically a sphere where, in a mathematical sense, the two opposite ends of the sphere are accelerated away from each other faster than the speed of light. That means that it doesn't matter whether I send a light ray inside or outside of the sphere, in the usual sense of the terminology, the cross-sectional area is always decreasing if I send them to the past, where space is rapidly shrinking towards the Big Bang. Okay? And the other way around, near the Big Crunch, near a future singularity, where the fabric of space and its contraction is more important than which side of the sphere you send your light ray to. Okay? And so it's not surprising that there exist precisely four domains such that within each domain the wedge is the same. One near the pole, another one near the other pole, and then near the Big Bang and Big Crunch. So now you've learned that this area has something to do with this entropy and with that entropy. Okay, and so on. All right? Now why does this work so nicely? For example, Fischer and Susskind also had a formulation in terms of light-like hypersurfaces. But they didn't know about this rule that picked, two of these four directions according to the inside rule. So they ran into a problem where they would have a surface very near the South Pole, for example, and the rule will tell them that it has something to do with the entropy across the entire big three sphere. Okay, the entropy on this null hypersurface. That obviously goes wrong because if you take the limit where the sphere goes to the pole, its area goes to zero, right? But the entropy is big. Now, this wedge tells you immediately that that was the wrong thing to do. The entropy that this area has anything to do with lies on either one of these two hypersurfaces, the ones that cover the polar cap, which is what, maybe you would have expected by common sense. And finally, I want to use this example of the closed universe. Let me also look at these big surfaces near the Big Bang that I talked about actually in the context of a flat universe. There you find that while in the spatial volume, the entropy could be larger than the area if you just make the surfaces large enough, the allowed directions go towards the Big Bang, where they are truncated by the Big Bang singularity. Your cones no longer look like that. They look like that. So you're really picking up only an annulus worth of the space-time and not what you would have thought you pick up according to the spatial prescription. Okay. So maybe that gives you an idea of how this rule conspires to make things work.
When you pass from one region to another, is it
phase? Well, no, I mean, what do you mean by pass? The rule is you pick an area, you give me an area, I tell you where the entropy is. Now, if you construct a some kind of world tube of, but which is totally arbitrary, I mean, you can just pick one, yeah, then there will be transitions where the direction in which your entropy lies flips, where the wedges flip. But I don't know whether that corresponds to any physically interesting question. This has a lot to do with these observational questions that you talked about, because the idea whether a light ray can traverse the system or not has exactly something to do, I think you said that, with whether you can complete a measurement before you hit a singularity or not. So it's actually also from an operational point of view a very sensible prescription. Let me just finally say one more thing.
Question?
Yes.
So this means you don't count entropy sort of coming out of the singularity, whatever that means. Right?
Well, the entropy that I'm counting the entropy that passes through this null hypersurface.
Right, which excludes the singularity.
Right, but the hypersurface does not overlap with the singularity except at this one place where it meets it.
No, so. But there's this whole, there's sort of the...
There's a hole, and that you don't, that entropy you don't see. Yeah.
You're not counting any stuff that
no.
would have come in there.
No. That's precisely what would lead to problems if I did that.
Right.
I mean, that's why I have this rule, so that the singularity truncates the hypersurface on which I consider entropy. Let me finish by coming back to this question that I raised in the context with Malgasena's work. What is the generalization in other spacetimes of these holographic screens that could be seen at the infinity of anti de Sitter space? So if I look at an entire spacetime, where do I want to store all the data? In anti de Sitter, I did this slice by slice, space-like slice by space-like slice. I could store the information about the bulk on this two-sphere at infinity. Okay? Now, from what we've learned about this new prescription, which works in terms of null hypersurfaces, it would seem that it's a good strategy, instead of slicing a spacetime into spatial hypersurfaces, to slice it into null hypersurfaces. That would be, for example, achieved by taking a whirl line and taking the past light cones from every point of that whirl line. Okay, that gives you sort of a stack of cones that completely foliate the spacetime. You could have chosen future ones as well. Now, let's do that in this example of a closed universe. Things are rotationally symmetric about r equals about the pole, so let me draw the light cones just by these diagonal lines. So you foliate like that. Okay. And now you remember that the entropy bound tells you something about the entropy in directions where the area is decreasing away from some area that you picked. So a clever area to pick to store information is the one that is maximal along these light cones. And there is a maximal area because the area starts out at zero at this tip. And it has to become zero again when you hit the Big Bang singularity. So there's a maximal area somewhere on the way. And it's also clear from these wedges that this maximal area is precisely where the wedges flip. Right, because these wedges tell you that along this light-like direction, the decreasing direction is that way. And that wedge tells you the decreasing direction is that way. So where they flip, let me draw the wedges again to make it clearer. They flip on this line. Right. And another way of saying this is that I could look slice by slice for the maximal area on each cone. Now, and then connect the dots. And that is the analogy to these dots that I'm connecting in ADS. Okay. So even though I have a spacetime that doesn't even have a boundary, I can construct holographic screens as embedded hypersurfaces. Now there are a few things that one can learn from this. And I think the most important is that things aren't going to be as simple as ADS in general, in the sense that it's hard to imagine how you would have an ordinary theory just living on this hypersurface. Ordinary theory that incorporates the idea that it has as many degrees of freedom as the area. That's possible here because the area can be taken to be constant. But here, the area is not constant. It starts at zero, becomes very large at the turnaround time, it shrinks again. I don't know a theory that has that kind of behavior in terms of its degrees of freedom. My personal suspicion is that these screens are important, but as an intermediate stage. We've learned from string theory that it's quite possible that a quantum theory of gravity is in some sense a pre-geometric theory, in that there's a dictionary which allows you to construct classical geometries in that regime of the theory that actually describes them. What I expect is that in general spacetimes, these screens will play an important role, and the holographic principle, in this reconstruction, because you can try to build your spacetime in such a way that the holographic principle is automatically satisfied for all areas and all light sheets associated with them. That's a strong constraint. Thanks for your patience.